doodlebugs. But that's what it was. Thank God you never knew them.
And how often?
Doodlebugs?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, because I didn't actually experience them. I mean, I heard them going over very frequently. I don't know how many times a day, but very frequently. They came at night as well, which was even more scary with the V1s, because suddenly you get a bomb coming out of the sky. An uncle of mine and his family had a direct hit from one of those V2s, as they were called, and the whole family was destroyed, including the house and everything. That was very sad. Mm. Yeah. So that was a nasty thing that happened.
How old were you when that happened?
Oh, I guess I was what? I was born in 1941. 1942. I don't know. How old would I be? My math is horrible.
1931, 42. So 11?
Yeah, 11, 12, something like that. But my cousin Monica, her father was in the Merchant Navy. In the on the patrol, the North Sea patrol, when the supply ships were coming in from America, bringing in food, the German torpedoes were there. Well, they called it Torpedo Alley, because if you know anything about the shape of the North Sea between America, North America, and England, you can see the shape of it, and there was that passage that they would take, and the German submarines would be there lying in wait, and they would sink them. And my uncle, that's Monica's father, his ship was sunk, so of course he was blown up by one of these torpedoes. Not very pleasant at all. Other than that, I don't think we had any other. Nobody else in the family was directly killed by the war.
How did that impact your family, losing them?
Didn't impact me at all. Did it impact my mother and my father? I suppose it did, but they never betrayed any. You have to understand, English people do not show their emotions. There's none of this carrying on. Not at all. You have it, but you don't show it. I might be a bit tearful, but that would be it. I'm always amused when I watch things on television of the hysteria that accompanies. And I don't mean to say this rudely, but you see the hysteria. Somebody goes to a hospital, the whole family comes and they're carrying on and wailing and behaving so poorly, and the doctors can't even do their work because they're in, is he all right? Is he going to live? You see none of that in England, but you do here. And that's why I think, God forbid, any of that situation should happen here. I don't know what would happen to the world here. They have no control. That sounds rude, but I don't mean it to be rude.
It's fine. Could you talk about emigrating from here?
Great Britain to here?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was in 1966. Just before that, we were living in England, my husband and my two children, well, three. Happened to be three, but at that time, two children. We were all very concerned. It was the time when every country wanted to ban the bomb. And if you read anything about that period, it wasn't so much here, but certainly in Europe, and certainly in England, there were marches, big marches, to ban the bomb, the atom bomb and the hydrogen bomb, and they were being tested out in the southern Pacific. That's where the bikini came from. You know the history of the bikini?
I know a bit.
The bikini is a very brief swimwear, but they tested those bombs at the Bikini Atoll. And it was very hot out there, so people were in shorthand for a silly story, but in any event, they were testing all these bombs, and the fallout was not just happening there, the fallout was coming because of the winds, the westerly winds, the easterly winds, whatever the winds were. They would bring all the fallout, the radioactive fallout, and affected the grass. The cows were eating that, and that was being passed through the milk. So there was a big ban on all these products, food products. Never happened in this country, but certainly in England and in parts of Europe it was. And people took that very seriously. They wanted to get rid of these bombs. They didn't want anything to do with them and didn't want any more testing. And so at that time, my husband and I were very concerned with other people of our age that this, we were involved in this. This was terrible. And we wanted to move away. You couldn't serve certain meats you couldn't eat because the cows and the pigs, everything, had been eating all that food, you know, from the grass and the soil. So we were very restricted. We felt we were restricted. And my husband said, you know, I think we should think of moving out of this country. We should perhaps go to America. And I said, well, I don't know, maybe. And at that time, he saw an advertisement in one of the London newspapers. The equivalent here would be the New York Times. This was the London Times, which is a very conservative paper, a very well-respected paper. If it was in the Times of London, God had spoken. That's how it was. And on the front page, funnily enough, there was no news. The front page, and it was in those days, the newspapers were quite big, much bigger than they are now. They didn't have to say print, but they do now. Were all advertisements, personal advertisements, the kind you might find now at the back of a magazine that would say, wanted, blonde girl, you know, interest in, like a personal. These were all personals, not necessarily looking for a mate, but it could be anything to do with your life. And anybody that had a secret message to pass on would be in a personal, like, call Mary, 315, you know the number. That might be a spy's message. These were the sort of things, and people used to put everything in there. So he came home one day and he said, you know what I saw in the Times today? There was an advertisement for people of every discipline who are dissatisfied with living conditions now here and want to get away from it all and to get together and find an area where it would be safe to live. In other words, a kind of utopia. We were young in those days. Oh, sounds wonderful. We should do that. So I said, are you going to go to the meeting? He said, yes, indeed. I'll find out about it. So I did not go. I said, well, you go and check it out, which he did do. He came back and he said, oh, it's good. This is what we should do. We should definitely do this. It's a marvellous group of people, very intellectual group, good educations. What they want to do is get together. They'd have somebody who is a doctor, which I am by this time, he was, people who know plumbing, people who know electricity, da-da-da-da, education, bit of everything, and we could set up a community. Sounds wonderful. We said, okay, we'll check it out more, which he did do, and in the end they threw him out. Because, as I said, he had a very inquiring mind. Oh, you weren't allowed to take any personal belongings. You just took what you had. You wouldn't take any paintings or any... You might be able to take the Bible, and that was it. So he had a wonderful collection, a very large and important collection of stamps. He was a stamp collector. So he brought this question up. He said to them, well, I have this important collection, and it could be considered educational because the stamps have all flora and fauna and all sorts of things on them. This could be used as an educational project. Could I bring them? Well, Dr. Okay, so he was allowed to do that, so that was good. Then another time he went in and he said, well, we haven't discussed corporal punishment. What kind of punishment would there be? Oh, Dr. Hyman, we're civilized, intelligent group of people. Why would we need punishment, legal punishment? Because people are people. And I think this is something that we should be discussing. Well, okay, well, maybe, you know, this and that. He said, well, what about, but we really don't need it because there won't be anything other than a reprimand. That'll all be necessary. And the disfavour of the rest of the group. Pie in your eye. So he said, well, what about murder? Oh, Dr. Hyman, how could you even suggest murder with this group? He said, because things happen. He said, and we're a mixed group of men and women. And supposing if X's husband went off with Y's wife and it led to a murder. Well, they were horrified at this idea. Anyway, he pursued it as he would. And they eventually said, well, I guess in that case we'd have to send them off in a boat. He said, well, if that isn't capital punishment, I don't know what is. So they said, Dr. Hyman, we see you're not suited for this group. So they threw him out. So he came back and he said, it ain't for us. But in actual fact, they did make a group. And they first of all went to Israel to see how it would be what it would be like living in a kibbutz, which is a communal existence. You probably are aware of that. How you have nothing except what you have. Everybody has the same property. A utopian kind of society, but they work hard and they wanted to see how this worked out. So they're there for about 5, maybe 6 months. They said, okay, we know how to do this. And then they got the money together, because these were well-heeled people. They weren't just anybody off the street. And they got the money together to buy an island off the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, which was good because at that area they weren't getting any fallout from these atomic testings. So they went there, and they were there, I suppose, for about 10 years. They did very well. And then they sort of broke up and went their ways. But it did work out to begin with. So then he said, I'm going to see if I can find a practice to join in anywhere, because being trained at a London teaching hospital, once people were trained, they went off to all parts of the world. It's the English way. You don't stay here, you go off. So he wrote to many of his friends who had gone off in the 10 years he'd been in practice. And the first answer that he got sounded interesting, and this was in America. So he said, well, I'm going to go over and check this out. He went to visit this person, came back totally seduced. He was here for about 3 weeks.
And in the said, United States?
The United States, yes, sorry. To New York. This is where the letter had come from. And he came back totally seduced. He was working in the National Health System, which was a wonderful system. But it meant very restricted in certain ways. So if he had an interesting case, he would pass that on to a specialist in a hospital, and that's the end. You didn't see that patient again. It was another division. Well, here, you could be an internist, and you might send your patient to be treated at a hospital, but you were still their doctor, and you could go in and visit them and see what was going on, and you could even have X-ray equipment in your own office, and you could do this, and you do tests. You could do a lot of stuff in your own office. And he was seduced by this. He said, oh, this is divine. This is what I should do. So he said, if I can pass the exam, that's what we'll do. Well, he did. So we packed up and we came to New York. He set up practice with this fellow. Didn't work out. The fellow was practiced medicine the way Basil did not like. He had a little black book. And when he introduced my husband to that, he came back and he said, you'll never guess what so-and-so showed me today. I said, no, what was that? He said, the little black book. And I said, well, what does that mean? He said, I was told by these are house calls you should make. You'll find them interesting. These were women that he could go and have 5 minutes pleasure with, or 10 minutes pleasure. And he said, this isn't the man for me. So he started his own practice, and that's what happened. So that's why we were here in America. For me, it was not pleasant, because I didn't understand anything here. The money was different, the cuts of meat were different, the driving on the other side of the road was different. It was very confusing, and I didn't care for it at all. But after a bit, it was okay. I have to go and excuse myself.
There we go. So you mentioned a little bit about culture shock, moving to the United States.
Well, yes, because it was... it was totally different from what I had experienced all my life up to that point. We arrived in June 1966, and I believe it was a heat wave in New York at that time. Very, very hot, and I had never experienced heat like it. None of us had. It was like coming into Dante's Inferno. It was unbearable. And of course we didn't have the right kind of clothes. We were wearing the kind of clothes we would be wearing in England in June, which is not heatwave at all. It would be like this. So of course we were dying of heat, and we came by ship. And when we arrived at in New York Harbor, we were being met by an aunt and some cousins. And we got off the ship, which was about, I don't know, I suppose about, we were up at about 5, because we came in under the Verrazano Bridge at about 6:30 in the morning we came through. So we had to be up very early before that. So it was a very long day. I think we actually got on land, if you like, at about, I don't know, 11:30 or so, 11:45 in the morning. Blazing heat. And inside the, what would you call that? I don't know. The shed, like a big shed we went into. It was even hotter, it was stifling. And all the noise and the clatter. And I had, this aunt was meeting us, and she's a very impatient woman. And every so often we would hear over the loudspeaker, because they were looking for our luggage and everything, will Dr. and Mrs. Hyman please make themselves known? And this would come over the thing, because she went up to wherever it was, harbour master, and said, I have to find my niece. She's just arrived from England with her children. Very excited, very hysterical woman. And she just took over the command. And so every so often we'd hear this voice, and then finally we got everything together. And then this cousin who had come to pick us up, she and her husband, he was also a physician, they had brought two cars because they knew with 5 of us and them and all the luggage. So she said, well, we have to go to Coney Island. That's the first thing you should see. Okay, so you do as you're told. You pile into the cars, and we went to Coney Island to eat hot dogs. And it was this blazing heat, and there are so much traffic, and the smells of everything, and the fire engines going, and the police sirens, and we're standing on the sidewalk eating these hot dogs, and I thought, this is a scene out of hell. What am I doing here? This is horrible. And then we had to tour. We got back in the cars, and she toured the whole area. We had to see all this, and then we had to go to Staten Island, where they were living. Okay. And so we got to Staten Island, and by this time it was about 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and they had horses, because in those days Staten Island is not like it is today. It was very bucolic. Now, you know, the bridge had just gone up, Verrazano Bridge, and the developers were starting to come in. But at that time the farms were still there, and they had horses, and they knew that I liked to ride, and her husband Bob was also a rider, that's why they had their horses. And so he said, we have to go riding now. I know you like that. I thought, oh, it's the last thing I want to do. I'm exhausted, but okay, you're polite. You say, oh, that would be lovely. How splendid. So quickly fished out some long trousers and went riding. But by that time, it was now 5 o'clock, and we're going over the golf course with the head of trail around that. And the mosquitoes are coming out. And then we're all bitten to death. And I thought, I don't believe this is happening. Can't believe it. And then, of course, my children were used to going to bed at 6 o'clock. That's what they had grown up with. That was the routine. But now it was gone 6 o'clock. They hadn't had supper or anything. So I said to Mimi, the cousin, I said, now can you tell me what the dinner arrangements will be? I'd like to give the children their supper and they can go to bed. She said, go to bed, it's daylight, why are they going to bed? I said, well, I think they need to go to bed, they're tired. Well, I haven't made the beds up or anything yet. Oh God, this was awful. So anyway, that was the beginning. And then my husband had to go in to do some more tests. So he was gone all day, and I was left. That part of Staten Island was very wild. It was all woods and everything. So I was left in this wooded area. God, you know, what the hell am I going to do with myself and the children? But anyway, things worked out. They always do, you know.
Yeah.
Just have to grit your teeth and get on with it.
You mentioned you arrived in the U.S. by boat.
By ship.
By
yeah.
ship. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the ship was lovely, actually. We were supposed to have come on the Queen Elizabeth, but Cunard went on strike, so they put us on the SS France, and it was a luxurious, beautiful boat, superb boat, and we were going cabin class, which was very nice, not first class, but it was one below that. And we had a very nice cabin, and the children had a cabin next door. The postage stamps, my husband's famous collection, had to come with us in our cabin because they shouldn't get lost. I mean, these were huge steamer trunks, the kind of thing you would send kids to camp with, huge, filled with stamps. So the ship was very luxurious. The children were very well taken care of. Julian, my youngest, was only 18 months old. They had nannies that came and took the little ones, put them in the that part of the ship where they were, keep them out of sight, and no noise, which is great. Very interesting. This wasn't an English ship. This was a French ship, but they had the same criteria. Children and servants always kept at the top of the house. If ever you go to, well, you know you've been to Europe, haven't you? You were in Germany, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you go to their big stately homes, you'll know the nurseries, or you'll notice that they're always at the, well, not now, but they were always at the top of the house. And the servants slept at the top of the house, out of sight, out of mind, because the nannies looked after the children. And God knows what they did. So, you know, oh yeah, they weren't always so good. They would, from the gas fires, they'd give the children a whiff of gas to make them sleep. Not unknown at all. Or a little brandy or a little gin in their feeding bottle to make them sleep. They didn't want to be disturbed by screaming kids. There were some wonderful ones, but a lot of them weren't so wonderful. But you never knew because they weren't anywhere near you.
Was it just you and your children, or did your husband come with you?
No, we all went as a family, en famille. My husband and I had one cabin, and the children, there were three of them, had one next door. There was a communicating door. So we travelled, and the journey in those days took 6 days across the Atlantic from Southampton to New York. It's the same time now, actually, it's no quicker.
Did they have activities on the ship?
Oh God, yes. They had, for the adults, there were lots of marvellous things to do. For the children, they also had a lot of games they would play with them. There was wonderful swimming. They had things like treasure hunts. Oh, they kept them occupied. They knew they would have to keep them well occupied, because if they were just, you know, making a fuss and being whingy and miserable, the parents wouldn't have a good time either, and they wouldn't travel that way. I mean, there were other ways you could travel, you could fly, but it seemed to us we had so much luggage, obviously better to come by boat. also was an experience that we thought would be fun, and it was. We met nice people, we had wonderful food, we had our own table in the dining room. For six people, we asked for a table of six, which we've always done when we've done all, you know, we've been on these round-the-world cruises six times. So we would always ask for a table of six. Four is no good because you could be stuck with dummies. And two is, you know, boring. You want to be with other people. And six is fine, dilutes. Eight is too many because you can't really talk to everybody. But six is a good number. Like when you go out for dinner with friends, six is a good number. Eight is no good. It's too big and too noisy and everybody orders something else. It's a nightmare. Mm-hmm. Six is a good number. So we had a table of six. And breakfast, you're usually on your own. And the food was exquisite and lovely, and you waited on hand and foot. 11 o'clock, you would be outside on the decks, walking. Everybody would walk the circumference of the ship about four times. That would be a mile. So you got your exercise in, and there were table tennis, bridge. A lot of people would play bridge. They had dance classes. In the evening, after dinner, people would dress in those days. You had to take evening dress with you, as we did when we went on the cruises. We had to dress every night except at the weekend. So you had a tuxedo and you had long dresses. And then they would do horse racing, which was a gambling kind of game, but a fun game. You had horses that were made out of plywood and painted, and you had them... you know what I... understanding what I'm saying.
Not real horses, yes.
No, they weren't real horses, but you would move them on with sticks.
Oh, yeah.
And you would have to get a dice, and if it said five, you'd move them five paces. I mean, it sounds very futile and silly, but in actual fact, it was fun. We'd all had a wonderful dinner. We'd all had some wine and drinks and what have you. So everybody, you know, was relaxed. So horse racing was a big, fun thing to do, and they had entertainers. There was always something to do. And wonderful library. These big ships, I don't know about Carnival Cruises, probably not, but the big important ships, Cunard and Holland America, they have wonderful libraries. You could spend every day in the library. So yes, it was enjoyable.
Could you talk to me about the work you've done, like career-wise?
Well, I've done a few things. Let me see. I had, when I was about 14, I told you I liked to ride, mm-hmm. and a friend of mine, Gillian Murray, her mother had a riding school, so they had some horses. And I had my horse Flicker and the use of another pony called Merrylegs. And so I said to Gillian, why don't we have a riding school of our own, just for young children? Both you and I could teach them quite easily. So we did. It was called the Black Bay Riding School because her pony was black. It wasn't really black, but it looked black. And mine, Flicker, was bay, which is a chestnut colour, which has a black mane and tail. Brown, but the black maiden tail is called a bay. So that's why we called them the Black Bay. And it was fine. We painted a wonderful sign and we put it on the gate of our property. And a neighbour came by and complained to my mother, this is a residential area, this is not commercial, they have to take it down. I'm not living next to a riding stable. Riding school, actually. So my mother said, you've got to take the sign down, but you can do an advertisement in the newspaper, which we did. So we used to teach children to ride, get very little for it, but that's what we did. That was the first thing. Then after that, when I was waiting to go up to the hospital that I had been given a place at, to get a place at a teaching hospital, one of the good hospitals, was like getting into a very good college. You had to apply, and you were lucky if you got a place. You had to write essays and all that stuff. It wasn't just a question of saying, please, can I come and be a nurse here? No. not in those hospitals, and I wanted to have a good training. So while I had about a year